the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, one of the big questions about retirement is how much money do you need, how much can you spend, and how long will that last? Joining us on the program from American College is the author of a new book called How Much Can I Spend in Retirement, Professor Wade Fow. Professor, let's start out with something about retirement. Most people approach retirement, they think about a certain number they need to have, and you get that magical number, and then all of a sudden everything is fine. But as we know, as we've seen over the last 17 years, we've had two bear markets. We've seen the lowest interest rates in recorded human history, and we know that people are living longer. So how does one come to grips with that elusive question? How much money can I spend?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. That's really the starting point. There was that rule of thumb developed by Bill Bingen in the 1990s, the 4% rule. And in large part, what I'm doing in this book is just trying to dig deeper into all the assumptions behind that. And explain, as you start to deviate from some of those classic assumptions, how much you really can spend. And in that regard, you know, the 4% rule of thumb, it's basically meaning that whatever you want to spend from your investments in retirement, you should save 25 times that, because when you take 4% of that number, then you get the spending level that you're hoping for. And that, again, there's a lot of assumptions behind that particular rule of thumb, and the book really just investigates all that.
Now, one of the popular strategies, or it's often recommended for retirement, is the 4% rule. Let's talk a little bit more about it, because that seems to be the standard, but how valid is it in this kind of environment compared to, let's say, when it was first promulgated in the 90s?
So the rule was developed by Bill Bingen in the early 1990s, and it's based on just assuming investors earn the underlying U.S. index historical returns, and then was calibrated to the worst-case scenario for a 30-year retirement period. So things are different now in regards to people are living longer. 30 years is no longer so conservative. And then interest rates are at historic lows. Stock market valuations are also on the high side. Both of those suggest lower stock and bond returns in the future. And in the U.S. historical data, especially 20th century U.S. market data, it was a pretty unique period in world history. In other studies, I've looked at international data and found that the 4% rule works about 2 out of 3 times historically throughout the world. And I think where we are with interest rates and market valuations and everything else today, that that's about the same sort of estimate for how reliable the 4% rule would be for U.S. retirees today versus in U.S. historical data, it did always work.
You know, one of the things that can really devastate a retirement is something that we call sequence risk. Let's just take an illustration. Let's say somebody had $1 million and they began their retirement. They're withdrawing 4%, so they're taking $40,000 a year out of their program. All of a sudden, Professor, they get hit with a bear market, maybe not as severe as the one we went through in 2007 and 9, or even the one that we went through in the year 2000. But nonetheless, we know that bear markets haven't disappeared. Business cycles are still in place. How do you handle something like that, given the very nature of the markets and given where we are today with an extended period of time?
Yeah, well, the 4% rule is really developed as a way to demonstrate that sequence of returns risk. It's the whole idea that for a particular retiree, they can't rely on what the markets will return on average over their retirement, but on the specific order that the returns happen. And if you get a bear market, bad returns early in retirement, that can start to dig a hole for a portfolio as you're taking distributions, such that even if the overall market recovers, the portfolio may not recover and a retiree may experience a lower spending rate than implied by overall average market returns. And that's what leads to the situation where when you always want to keep a sustained spending level and you're using a volatile investment portfolio, you might end up having to spend a lot less than you would think based on average market performance over retirement.
So how does one mitigate that? I know you advocate there's several strategies. One might be carrying a large cash balance that you can rely on during a downturn rather than spending or selling shares at lower prices.
Yeah, that would be an example of a buffer asset. So there's four basic ways to manage sequence risk. The first is to spend conservatively from a volatile investment portfolio that's seeking upside growth. And that's what the 4% rule is about. That's meant to be the conservative number based on the U.S. historical data. I'm just not sure it's conservative enough. But also spending flexibly. Sequence risk is really triggered by selling assets at a loss. So if you're able to cut spending after a market downturn, that can help mitigate the sequence of returns risk and allow for a higher initial spending rate. The third approach is to reduce portfolio volatility. And that doesn't just mean going into bonds, because Bill Bengen's original research recommended holding at least 50% stocks. And that's something that shows up again and again. As soon as you want to spend more than bonds can support, then bonds just lock in failure. And if you're not going to consider other annuity type strategies, you've got to seek upside growth potential through the stock market. So reducing volatility, there's a number of different possible directions to go with that. And then the fourth approach is the buffer asset approach, where you have something outside the investment portfolio that's not correlated, and that even if the stock market is down, this buffer asset does not decline in value. So cash was the popular version of that going back to the 1980s when interest rates were a lot higher. Today, two other common buffer assets are cash value for permanent life insurance or a growing line of credit on a reverse mortgage.
So those are some of the examples that you use. What about, let's take a case that is reality for many retirees today. Let's say, Professor, you retired in the year 2000. Back then, interest rates, you could have got 5, 6, 7% fairly easily. We were just coming off one of the greatest bull markets in history. If you take that period of time from, let's say, January 2000 until spring of 2013, the stock market virtually went nowhere in price. It went up and then it went down again, and it would take after spring of 2013 before we actually began to make real gains. Secondly, during that same period of time, we saw interest rates brought down to very, very low single digits under Greenspan. And then they rose a bit prior to the financial crisis, but then they were brought down to zero. So if you were relying on predictability, like for the stock market or for the bond market, in either case, you did not get the returns that you thought you were going to get, and you could have been drawing down quite a bit of your principal.
Right. That's the fundamental danger of trying to manage retirement with an investment portfolio, that you try to pick a conservative spending number, but there's still no guarantee that even that will work. And yeah, if you retired in the year 2000, it was a really wild ride with the stock market. There were other things that ended up helping, such as with the bond, if you're spending from bond mutual funds, as interest rates came down, you were still getting capital gains on the bonds that today, with interest rates now starting from a low point, won't be able to continue in the future to such an extent. And then inflation has been low, and that also has helped with traditional spending strategies where you're not having to make huge adjustments to account for the impacts of inflation. But definitely for people retired in 2000, I was really worried that the 4% rule might not work for those retirements. It may end up squeaking out, but it's definitely those retirements are going to be on the lower end of the spending spectrum where those conservative numbers come into play, and not like a more average retirement where you, on average, you might be able to use 6.5% or 7% as a withdrawal rate. But that's not going to be the situation for those retirees around 2000.
You know, the other thing that plagues a lot of individuals that retire is, number one, they're living longer, so those funds have to take care of both parties over a longer period of time. Also, we are seeing higher medical expenses. We saw that with the tiered system that was put in place under George W. Bush on Medicare. So retirees are spending more and more money. And unfortunately, that money that they end up spending comes in the latter years of their retirement. How does one deal with that? Because let's say your budget is, I don't know, you're spending $5,000 or $6,000 a month today to live. We know, Professor, 10, 15 years from now, especially when you're more likely to run into medical issues, it's going to be a lot more.
Yeah, and that's really, so David Blanchett did research about average spending patterns and found that retirement spending smile, that indeed, at the end of life, health expenses really pick up, and that could cause the overall expenses to skyrocket. But he also then found in the years leading up to the end of life, people are often reducing their spending relative to inflation. Their spending doesn't need to keep pace with inflation. So those two factors do offset each other to some extent. But I mean, that's certainly a concern as well, is just you need to have some other liquid assets that aren't really earmarked for your baseline retirement spending to be able to help manage any sort of spending shocks like that that can come up along the way and require additional expenditures beyond what you really had anticipated as part of your baseline budget.
So when you take a look at those kind of expenses, what about the concept of, let's say, working part-time and living off, let's say, part-time income and preserving and allowing your assets to accumulate? What about that as an effective strategy in terms of dealing with these long-term care risks?
Yeah, absolutely. Any effort to delay retirement and or just reduce the need to take distributions from investments because you're working part-time and being able to help support some of the lifestyle through part-time work. That is a very effective approach to making sure the retirement plan stays on track. It's the longer you can delay retirement, it just helps in so many ways in terms of more savings, more time for previous wealth to grow before you start spending from it, and a shorter retirement horizon afterwards, and also helping with the ability to delay Social Security. It's just a really powerful method, and anything along those lines, part-time work and retirement, can really go a long way towards helping anyone's retirement plan.
What about the issue of Social Security? For many retirees, it's their main source of steady income. And it seems to me, given what we've seen take place in the markets over the last couple decades, one of the most important issues is a form of stability, which is Social Security. What other type of investments can one put in place to create that kind of stability? Because we're no longer in that period, Wade, as you know, 30, 40 years ago, a husband went to work for a company, worked maybe 30, 40 years, retired with a defined benefit pension. Between the pension and Social Security, they were pretty set. That's not the world we live in today. So what else can create stability in retirement?
Right. Well, Social Security really is the most stable, and that's why there's so much value in delaying claiming the benefits. It's CPI, inflation-adjusted income. It includes survivor benefits, and it's a lifetime income. So for individuals that have Social Security but may not have a traditional company pension that provides that guaranteed income for life, you can look to fill that gap with an insurance contract, an annuity lifetime income guarantee that can serve, play the same role as Social Security and as the traditional pension benefit that may no longer be available.
Now, you have looked at various strategies, and one of them was to, for example, use an immediate annuity in place of a bond, so you have that predictability of a monthly check coming in, just like Social Security, combining it with stocks that have the ability to increase not only income, but in terms of appreciation over time. Talk about that strategy and how that works in terms of, let's say, other types of strategies you have found to deliver predictable results throughout retirement.
Yeah, that's really the most efficient strategy that I found, and it's for meeting a spending goal in retirement. Bond mutual funds really, or any sort of like bond ETFs, anything like that, don't really work. An income annuity plays the role of the bond, but it provides the income for as long as necessary. Bonds don't provide mortality credits. They don't provide the subsidies to those who live longer, but the income annuity does. And by providing that sort of lifetime guarantee for income, that increases the risk capacity of the household, that their lifestyle is no longer vulnerable to a stock market downturn. So by more cheaply and efficiently earmarking a smaller portion of the assets to cover lifetime income through the income guarantee, with the rest of the assets, you now have more risk capacity. You don't have to, but you can invest more aggressively and seek more upside growth. And so the efficient frontier for retirement income really becomes a combination of income annuities and stocks. And when it comes to meeting retirement spending, there's not really much of a need for bonds. Bonds are just not efficient.
Then why, Professor, explain, why do annuities get such a rap? In fact, you have prominent money managers sometimes, one in particular, on television, degrades annuities as a bad thing, that they're not appropriate. It seems like there's two sides to the annuity story. There's many like yourself that have done research in terms of the role they play in retirement and how they can bring stability to a portfolio. On the other hand, you have the investment world, especially Wall Street, and money managers that don't like them and think they're a terrible investment.
Well, they're not supposed to be an investment, but they're supposed to be insurance. But that's absolutely right. It's, academics love lifetime income guarantees, but they're not really getting pushed hard in terms of, especially on the investment side. There's this concept of annuicide. Any investment manager that charges based on the amount of assets they can manage has to give up assets whenever the client purchases an annuity. And so that takes away, like if I put 30% of my assets into an annuity, that investment manager is now losing 30% of their revenues. And so they have a strong financial incentive to discourage the use of annuities. And if they're serving as a fiduciary so that they're supposed to put their clients' interests first, they now have to convince themselves in their mind that annuities are bad. And certainly not all annuities are created equal, and they can be misused and not used in the appropriate ways, mainly because they're not used to provide lifetime income, which is really what they're good at. So, but then those kind of bad cases get amplified and extrapolated to try to paint the entire annuity world as bad, when annuities are not bad. They provide lifetime income. They provide a source of returns that investments cannot provide. And they're really competitive. It's very difficult for the stock market to beat an annuity. It's not impossible, but I think investment managers think it's almost certain that stocks will beat annuities. And that's just not the case at all. You've got risk premium, the idea that the stock market will outperform the bond market, up against risk pooling, the ability to pool the risk and to provide everyone in the risk pool an income like they'll live to life expectancy, rather than that individual spending less because they're worried about living to 90 or 95 or 100. And that risk pooling is a really powerful tool to help more efficiently manage retirement risks and get a better retirement outcome.
Well, let's get back to the theme of your book, determining how much I can spend in retirement. In your book, you outline 9 strategies. I wonder if we can cover some of the main ones and how they would apply.
Yeah, that would be the chapter on variable spending strategies. And that's when I talked about the 4 ways to manage sequence of returns risk. That would be spending flexibly, being able to adjust your spending in response to market performance, and especially if you can make cuts to spending after market downturns, then that will help get the retirement plan to stay on track. And so, right, in that chapter on variable spending, flexible spending strategies, I look at 9 strategies other than the classic Bankin rule of how to adjust spending over time, comparing them all on an equal basis with equivalent amounts of downside risk and so forth. Because it's hard to compare those strategies. Whenever you have a strategy that will reduce spending in a lead up to portfolio depletion, you can't directly compare that to a strategy that just keeps spending, 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 and then spending drops to zero at the end. So you need tools to be able to compare these on an equal basis. And that's what I've tried to do. And looked at different strategies, some of like endowment formulas, for example, how you spend a percentage of the 3-year moving average of the portfolio, or just a fixed percentage rule where you take a fixed percentage of what's left every year. I looked at floor and ceiling rules where you put boundaries on how high spending can go or how low it can go. I've looked at Michael Kitsy's ratcheting rule, which is a rule that doesn't have the downside protection, but it just tells you when you can increase spending. Jonathan Guyton and William Klinger's decision rules, a series of rules about when to increase and decrease spending. The RMD rule, that required minimum distributions are meant to spend down an asset base over retirement, and they're actually pretty close to a sort of academically efficient spending strategy from an investment portfolio. So just looking at all those rules and how they perform on the upside, on the downside, and looking at different metrics to compare their performance. That's what that chapter is all about.
Have you found one to work better than another one? In other words, as you examine each of these and their predictability and success, does anyone stand out among the 9?
I was kind of fond of Bill Bengen's floor and ceiling rule, which is it's a hard floor and a hard ceiling. For example, if I'm going to start with a 4% spending rate, so the $40,000, I might say I'll let my spending fluctuate in between, say, $35,000 and $50,000. Won't let it go outside of those bounds. And that ability for the downside to be able to reduce spending helps to manage sequence risk in an effective way so that you can spend more initially, and then you might actually be able to pull up that floor to a level pretty close to where you would be if you were just never going to have a potential to downward adjust your spending. So the William Bengen's floor and ceiling rule, that's one of my favorites from the possibilities.
Yeah, one of the things that I have found works very well, I have clients, as many retirees, spend a lot of what I call extra income on travel. During downturns, they just simply adjust their travel budget instead of taking trips to Europe or Australia or China, places that would cost a lot more money. Maybe they go visit the kids or stay in the U.S. where they spend less.
Yeah, and that can be a practical way to implement those sorts of rules that are calling for occasional downward spending adjustments to take it from those discretionary expenses, spend less in some years than others.
And don't you think that's important, Professor, why you need a budget for retirement? Let's say you can break it into three categories, your basic budget, which is your basic needs to live, discretionary, or what I call things you'd like to do budget, which is travel, hobbies, and then kind of a wish list or a bucket list of, hey, you know, I'd like to buy a sailboat, I'd like to buy a motorhome. And you break it up into those three categories. So therefore, you have a lot more flexibility if you do face a downturn, or as we did in that downturn where the interest returns on a lot of investments fell sharply.
Yeah, I agree with that approach. That's not universally accepted in terms of making the distinction between core essential types of expenses and more discretionary expenses and even more of a like a bucket wish list, like you said. I think that's a great way to approach it. Some people just say, here's your standard of living, and if you can't meet the whole thing, your retirement's a failure. But I think in practice, what you described makes a lot more sense. One of the examples there is, you know, try to sit with a couple and classify things as essential or discretionary, and like cable TV bills and country club memberships. And it may be hard in practice to always make those lists clearly, but I think it definitely helps to work in that direction and to be thinking along those lines.
So if you were to boil this down to four or five easy steps, Professor, what would they be?
Well, the way I kind of boil it down in the book is I have the retirement care analysis at the end, which just looks at here's all the factors to be thinking about with regard to how much you can spend. And you have to start with how much you want to spend. So we'll start with the budget. What is the nice spending goal and how is that differentiated between those three categories you mentioned, essential and discretionary and more aspirational? But then beyond that, the care analysis, C is for capacity, like how much capacity do you have? Do you have flexibility? Can you adjust your spending? Do you have risk capacity? How vulnerable is your lifestyle? Do you have other income sources outside of investments and so forth? Your aspirations, how much you really do want to spend? The realities about what you should expect for future market returns based on where interest rates are and so forth. And then emotional constraints. Are there tools that are off the table, or do you have trouble? Do you fall into behavioral traps with investing, tend to buy high and sell low and that sorts of thing, And just thinking through this list of factors to help guide the decision making around how much you can feel comfortable spending, how much ability you have to adjust that spending and so forth.
Well, those are some good practical steps, but, you know, they all begin with a plan. And that's one of the sorry things you hear about when you read about the retirement situation today. Very few people have plans. What do you think that is?
Yeah, I think a lot of times the whole planning process is uncomfortable for people. Sometimes people enjoy doing that sort of thing, but if it's not something a person enjoys, it's easier to fall into inertia and to just never get around to doing that. And certainly there are things in my life. I do enjoy the planning process more, but there's other areas where I definitely fall into the sort of inertia that it's just not something that I want to do. And so it's very hard to take action and get it done. And I think that's the problem for a lot of people. They may not know where to start, or may think it's too complicated, or may just not want to be planning for, although retirement can be fun, but with some of the associated like long-term care planning and estate planning and life insurance, it's not so comfortable to be thinking about those things. So that may be a real stumbling block for a lot of people.
Well, one good place to start would be to get a copy of your book. Professor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. The name of the book is How Much Can I Spend in Retirement? A Guide to Investment-Based Retirement Income Strategies, authored by my guest, Dr. Wade Pfau. Wade, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Much success with this book. It's a great book, and I think it's badly needed.
Well, thank you, and it's always a pleasure being on your show, so thank you very much.
Well, that concludes my interview with Dr. Wade Pfau. He's written a great book, and he's done a lot of research on spending strategies. There's a number of them. In fact, a whole chapter on 9 different strategies you can look at. Maybe not all of them may fit you, but there's certainly got to be one in there that may fit your personal situation. Highly recommend the book. It's one of the best books I've read on spending strategies in retirement. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.